www.ccbk.org.
Hi, this is Lila Downs. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, globally on kpfk.org.
En una noche de luna, Naila lloraba ante mí.
Maria Hall welcoming you to this week's edition of the Lawyers Guild Show. My friend and co-host Jim Lafferty is on vacation, but he'll be back soon. And in the meantime, we've got a wonderful show planned for you today. First, we'll be speaking with two historians, activists, and authors whose new book answers the question, who really makes history, in a refreshing, fun, and inspiring way. And as a bonus, we've got their publisher here with us, too. And then a little later on in the show, we'll get an update from the U.S. Julian Assange Defense Committee about the decision that came down from the U.K. court earlier this week. So let's go ahead, jump in, and get started. We've heard it said that if we don't know history, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes from the past. And just as important, if we don't know history, we're doomed to forget the valuable lessons that come from hard-fought struggles of the past. Lessons on what is affirming and sustainable, and about what kind of world we want to create for ourselves and for each other. There are infinite lessons that we can learn from the past. But just whose history are being passed on? And from whose perspectives are their stories told? Well, our next guests have a lot to say on this subject. I'm so happy to introduce historians, activists, and writers Steve Thornton and Andy Piasek, authors of a new book called Radical Connecticut, People's History in the Constitution State. Steve Thornton has been an activist in Hartford since the 1970s. He worked for many years for the Hartford-based Healthcare Workers Union, New England District 1199, and has been involved in many organizations and campaigns there over for the last 40 years. He also has a keen interest in local people's history, and some years ago he started the website shoeleatherhistoryproject.com to popularize that history. And we also have Andy Piasek, who is a native of Bridgeport, Connecticut. And Andy is an award-winning author who writes for many publications and websites, including Counterpunch and ZNetwork.org. And he's the author of several books, both fiction and nonfiction. And as a bonus, we also have back with us on the show today, the publisher of Radical Connecticut, People's History in the Constitution State, Timothy Sheard. Timothy is the founder of Hardball and Little Heroes Press, which is, quote, run by activists promoting worker-writers to counter the rabid anti-working class narratives produced by the one percenters with our own honest histories about work, family, community, and social justice, all my favorite subjects. And fun fact, Timothy is also an activist and writer himself, as well as a musician and composer of musicals, which we'd love to have him back to talk about that on another show. So I'm so grateful to have all of you with us here today on the Lawyers Guild Show. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yes.
Thank you, Maria.
My pleasure.
Happy to be here.
Great. So I'd like to start off with a basic question to Andy and or Stephen that our Southern California listeners may be wondering, well, what's so special about Connecticut history? That's on the East Coast. And of course, how is it relevant to our life here in California in 2024?
Well, if I can start,
please.
The history we research and publish isn't nostalgia. The events and the individuals described in our book are linked in many ways to national struggles and international campaigns. Our local stories, I think, help provide a new perspective to help activists better understand the big picture, the wider movement. The radical action from our small state reminds us that we're not alone in the world and that we can learn from each other. We tend to slip, I think this is across the country, we tend to slip in what we used to call a small mountain mentality. And that's and anything important that we on the left have achieved is located just in the big cities. That's a significant blind spot. So we try to develop the parallels and show if there are lessons and give inspiration to people who are maybe just starting out or maybe have a long, difficult history with the various movement activities that we're describing.
I would just add that very quickly, what's special about people's history in Connecticut is the same thing that's special about people's history everywhere else. It's resistance to entrenched power with a goal and a vision of a better way for us to organize society.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And Andy and Stephen both, in your own words, who is it who really makes history?
Andy, you want to field that?
Well, I think if take, say, Steve and I both have history in the labor movement. You know, it's not Samuel Colt, who was a prominent industrialist, infamous industrialist in Connecticut, or any big corporate head or whatever around the country. I mean, it's actually the people who do the work in the hospitals, in factories, in classrooms, in offices, who both produce what is useful for us as a population and also who drive the society forward in one way or another. You know, when people come to recognize that there are injustices in workplaces or communities where they live, if they successfully band together to do something about it, then that achieves an end result that is better for all. So I think that the emphasis, obviously, when you're talking about private power's vision of history, is on generals, industrialists, corporate politicians, and the like, whereas we think that's just a basic inaccurate description of how society really moves forward. When you really dig into it deeply, what you see is that entrenched power at pretty much every stage opposed everything that we would consider to be progress now, whether it's an end to slavery, whether it's an end to child labor, whether it's equal rights for women, all the various changes that have somehow led us to this point where we have some collective freedom. And I mean, that's come about because of work that everyday people did, and that was often very violently and vigorously opposed by the powers that be.
Mm-hmm. And was that kind of your inspiration for compiling these stories? Now, maybe you can give our listeners just a little preview of what the book is about and kind of what inspired you to compile all these stories, collect these stories, and do the research and talk to so many people that led you to compile this book.
Well, I was a child of the 60s. And by the time I got out of high school, I rejected everything that was American. And that included American history. I was not taught, and I didn't believe, that people had struggled and won and improved the world. I only knew the world as it existed from, you know, my little high school. But I started to do some reading after high school, and these little pieces of information that made me very curious, I then followed up on. And once I did that, that was just like this, the thread being pulled. I couldn't I couldn't really stop because I realized that things that I had learned about what had been going on in San Francisco or Los Angeles was actually stuff that happened in parallel time right here. And so that got me hooked. The second thing was I've been a union organizer until I retired for 40 years. And I realized that nobody who works hardly knows their history, the history of their workplace. In fact, they may have had big victories, but a year later, when you ask them about them, they can't remember them. So it's really important to write it down, to reinforce it, to give people the credit they deserve. And I think that history storytelling is part of organizing.
And you know,
yeah, I think it goes hand in hand with the movements and organizations that we've all been involved in. Having some kind of sense of what came before, both by people who did work that was very similar to your, whatever you might be doing, or things that might necessarily be similar, helps you to understand better the situation that you're in. It can also be inspirational, you know, not necessarily any blueprints, but knowing that people, say in this case, right in your own local community, did battle over union rights or against police brutality 50, 70, 100 years ago or whatever it might be, can be something that can help people keep going at times when they feel isolated or down or, you know, depressed about whatever the current situation might be. So I think between Steve, Tim, Thea, and myself, you know, we have certain skills as writers. Other people have other skills that are equally important that they can do better than we can. But contributing in this way, I do think, does help with the overall, you know, goal of trying to build a new society.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to ask you both to share some of your favorite stories in the book, but I want to give Timothy a little bit of time to weigh in here too.
I think you could turn down your volume.
Timothy, you may need to stay on mute, but I'm going to mute when I give your when I give you time to talk. but I want to ask you the question: how does Radical Connecticut, this book, exemplify the kind of books that Hardball and Little Heroes Press likes to publish? What's kind of your purpose in getting these stories out?
Well, Tim's business, Hardball Press, is one of a kind, really. He prints authors who are unknown otherwise and are given a chance to tell their stories, usually, often, their workplace stories. In fact, Tim's written, I don't know, 8-10 books when he was a union worker in a nursing home, and he's based that, you know, in these great murder mystery novels. And that's where I first learned about him. And that was, you know, it was good to know because he's a very generous guy who wants to get the word out there, especially now with children's books as well.
Yeah, go ahead, Timothy. Well, the rest of us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Maria. Yes, it was a great joy to me for Steve and Andy to send me their work, because I'm interested in publishing stories written by working class people and about working class people, ordinary people who really make the world that we live in, and to get their collection of stories about people in Connecticut who, for the most part, are unknown in history, because the historians want to write about, you know, the generals and the politicians. It's just wonderful to hear their stories being told. And they're so moving. They're so inspiring. They show us what we can do today, how we can stand up today as Andy was saying, against the power structure and demand our rights. And that's what the people in these books did. Starting in the revolutionary period, history goes way back. People who stood up to the crown and then stood up to the new rulers in America. So it's exactly the kind of stories that I like to publish and I like to try and bring to the world.
Amazing. Well, I just want to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your co-host, Maria Hall, and we're speaking today with Andy Piasek and Steve Thornton, authors of Radical Connecticut, People's History of the Constitution State, along with publisher Timothy Sheard from Hardball and Little Heroes Press. Well, now I would love to hear from Andy and Steve about some of your favorite stories from the book. Really, you know, let our listeners know what kinds of stories you came out to tell.
Well, I can start. This goes along with the idea I've come up with, probably not the first, that history isn't just a series of moments, but it's like a river. We all jump in and it takes us. And and I was thinking about the encampments in California universities and Connecticut universities and everywhere in between. That those are in a, whether students know it or not, they're in a great tradition. And one part of that tradition that I go back to is when welfare moms in Connecticut set up a tent city in 1971 at the state capitol, because this really evil, nasty governor was going to slash and burn the social service safety net. And a leader named Isabel Blake wouldn't let that happen. And she was key to organizing people all over the state. And they stayed on the Capitol lawn for 2 or 3 weeks, despite the governor's threats. Now, 12 years later, maybe, there were these homeless guys that I was working with in Hartford. Their shelter was being closed down, and not that they loved their shelter, but they knew that they had been left out of policymaking. And I told them that story about Isabel Blake, and not to tell them that we should have a tent city, but just to let them know how bold and courageous those people were and how their organizing produced good results. And by the end of the meeting, they had decided that they wanted a direct action group too. I didn't say, hey, let's do this. Let's get a barn and put on a show. I just gave them that story. They decided they wanted it. And the next day they took over City Hall. And that began a whole conversation on affordable housing, which didn't exist, homelessness, and all the related issues.
Wow.
Yeah, so.
That is an amazing story.
One for me that was a delight to discover, because I hadn't really known about it until I dug into the research, was a sit-down strike that took place in Bridgeport in 1937, just several months after the very famous sit-down strike that took place at General Motors factory in Flint, Michigan. It was the same kind of situation where the workers had decided upon a collective bargaining representative that they want to speak on their behalf with management. Management was refusing to recognize the union. And so the workers did what was radically different at that time, because a traditional strike is where workers withdraw themselves from the factory, set up picket lines, and do what best they can to prevent other workers from going in and basically to shut down production from outside. What the GM workers did and what the workers did at this Casco factory in Bridgeport was to remain in the factory as a way to more effectively, I would say, stop production and pressure management in that way to recognize their demands. It wasn't a very long sit-down strike. It was not on the scale by any means of General Motors' empire, but the end result was the same, in that the strike was successful and management agreed to recognize the UE as the collective bargaining union of the workers. And I think, as Steve was saying, you know, it had a ripple effect, as the labor movement at that time did in much of the country, where in the years that followed, the UE became a very potent force in Bridgeport. More and more shops in a very highly industrialized city at that time, not just the UE, but many others, won union recognition. And the end result in the short term was better living standards for the workers, a stronger sense of power in the workplace, in their relationship with their employers, and a greater sense of what they were capable of, because in all these sit-down strikes that took place around the country, including the one in Bridgeport, workers from other factories around the city came to the plant to support them from the outside. They had a whole system set up where they were going to use pulleys and levers to get food up to the people who were on higher floors. And I think it's the kind of thing that can continue to inspire us right down to today, even though not long thereafter, not surprisingly, sit-down strikes were declared to be unlawful. I will reference one that happened, I think, about 15 years ago in Chicago at the Republic Windows and Doors factory, where workers did effectively use a sit-down strike, illegalities notwithstanding, because they were together enough, they were strong enough, they had a strong enough solidarity network from people from around the city, and they went ahead and succeeded in preventing the company from shutting the factory down, and have, as far as I understand it, I've kind of lost track of the story a little bit, but they have collectively owned the plant in the years ever since, and it is still up and running 15 or 20 years or whatever it is later. So
that's right. It's self-managed now still. It's smaller, but despite a lot of financial problems, they've been able to keep it, and it's called New Era Windows now.
Okay.
So they got a lot to be proud of.
So I think there are a lot of valuable lessons, you know, in the story in some way that Steve just told is similar in that, you know, a courageous group of people took a stand and did something that had reverberations beyond what they did, that they had no idea that they were going to have that kind of impact. But, you know, it still felt to right down to today, and I think there's a lot that can be learned from that, from people, and not just in the labor movement either. So I found that to be, and it was also special for me because I really didn't know anything about it, and I was very excited to find that there had been a sit-down strike in what's a relatively small city compared to Cleveland or Detroit or the many other places where there have been well-known sit-down strikes.
You know, Maria.
Yes.
The as Andy's talking about these groups of people who are struggling for their rights, it made me think that one of the other things that we both do in this book is to talk about individuals that whom we know are not known. They're not known by local historians or local historical societies or politicians. And so they've gotten no credit for the work they've done. And two of them, if I can, One was a woman named Nancy Jackson. In 1837, she was an enslaved woman. She was living in Hartford for a family that was living in, belonged in Georgia, but they were living in Hartford for a few years. Now, she was in Connecticut where there was no slavery, and she decided she was going to free herself. With some abolitionists' help, she sued her so-called owner, and she won the case, despite that he and a preacher lied through their teeth about him. The court actually made new law and said this woman's in a free state, so she's free. Now, the most effective fact that I found was that if she didn't win, she had sewn two opium pills in her dress pocket. because she pledged she would never go back to slavery alive. Mm. And that is, I mean, that is heroic. And it's just her and a very small group of people.
Wow. And trying to depend on a system to bring justice that,
yes,
you know, was meant, it was designed not to give her freedom.
Yes.
So the what other happened? One is,
yeah. I'm sorry.
So what happened with her?
She became a free woman. She didn't have a lot of education. She was a domestic worker, but she got to know Teddy Roosevelt when he was a kid. Actually wrote him letters when he was president. Say, hi, how are you doing? I just wanted to know that I'm here. And you remember when you used to play in, you know, that kind of stuff. Wow. So she was clearly somebody who had, she didn't live off her fame at all. But it sounded like she was content. And she had to be proud of herself.
Wow. And what a story for her family and friends. And just even for us today, that was so long ago. But it is, you know, in times like today, a question that a lot of people have, and myself included, you know, we think about, would we really have that kind of courage? And I think the only way that we can honestly say yes is if we have other people around us that are also doing the same. And then we have these examples, which are so fabulous. So that does segue beautifully into my next question, which is, what are some of the broader lessons learned about strategy and organizing for social justice? And I do love that story of justice as well. What are some of those lessons from the book that you really thought, wow, these are really pertinent for these crazy times we're living in right now?
I've got a lesson.
I think it's much
I don't mean to jump in,
already.
Andy. Go ahead.
Like, there's no blueprint, there's no formula. It's just a matter of trying to figure out what the right thing is to do and what the most effective way is to do it. And I think it's also important, as we both talked in the different examples we've discussed, to keep an eye on the long view, because you may suffer what seemed to be a defeat and what may actually be a defeat in the short term. But over time, when conditions change or when a movement gets stronger, just think, for example, back to 2020. I mean, there are hundreds, probably thousands of very dedicated activists who did work around police violence, particularly against African Americans, for many, many years. And you'd call a demonstration after an incident where someone was injured or killed or what have you, and 50 people, depending on what the location is that you were organizing in, might come, maybe 100. And then all of a sudden, the spring of 2020, there's this one particularly gruesome incident, and you literally have hundreds of thousands of people, probably millions of people, from the smallest towns you can think of on up to the biggest city, out demonstrating day after day after day after day, for a period of 4 or 5 months. So, Steve and Timothy may speak better to specifics about strategies and stuff like that. I just find that if you can find the way to grind through, the chances are, and you're doing work in such a way that it actually speaks to people in a sensible manner, even though the results in the short term may not be what you would like and may even be kind of frighteningly small, over time, things can really just explode out of nowhere. I don't think there was anybody who could have predicted what would have happened in 2020 after the murder of George Floyd, the way so many people participated, including probably a majority of whom had never attended any kind of a demonstration before in their lives, certainly not one against police violence. So I don't know if Timothy and Steve can chime in better about specific things.
I think what Andy's talking about has to do with something that Howard Zinn said a long time ago. Because actually, besides a historian, he was a pretty darn good strategist. And he said that we look for moments of fugitive moments of compassion, and that we have to grab those, and those aid us in our organizing. They're just one event doesn't do it, but those moments are important. And I think Cornel West says the same thing, moments of interruption. That when we get involved in that, it has a bigger impact than just people walking out of a school or walking out of a factory. And an example, I think, of the developing of tactics and strategy in our book comes from the Colt firearms strike, because Colt manufactured and still manufactures weapons since the 1800s and in Hartford. And in 1986, 1,000 workers went on strike there after being pushed to the limit for over a year by the boss. The boss admitted he was in good financial shape, but he didn't care about that. He wanted the union gone. It was not going well in the first 3 weeks, first month. The whole strike lasted 4 years. It was not going well. And then the community figured out a way to actually unite with the workers. And this was like totally different coasts, totally different countries of people coming together. And within the coalition, there were the first electoral organizing and movement organizing of the lesbian, gay, bi, transsexual community was feeling its strength and got involved in that. And that shook the heck out of the strikers, but the boss didn't know what to do with that. And the coalition kept growing, and it really gave the only thing it could give to these strikers, which was moral support. And for 4 years they did, until they finally won their strike, bought the company, got millions of dollars in back pay and pension funds. They had taken a beating, but in the end they came out victorious.
Wow, what a great story. We have to pause for a very quick 30-second station ID break, and then I know Tim Sheard also wanted to add a few things there, but let's just take our break, and we will be right back.
We are gentle and people.
Support comes from the Will Gear Theatricum Botanicum, presenting renowned singer, songwriter, agent of social change, and political artist Holly Neer. Thursday, June 13th, 2024, at 7:30 p.m. Holly Neer has had an amazing, exemplary life of artistry, performance, songwriting, and activism. Holly's songs and anthems continue to lift our spirits as we work together for women's rights, social justice, and peace. The Theatricum Botanicum is located at 1419 North Topanga Canyon Boulevard in Topanga. For more information and tickets, visit theatricum.com and kpfk.org.
Singing for our lives.
Near love, welcome.
Get up, stand up.
All right.
Stand up for your
back
right.
To the Lawyers Guild Show. And yes, that was a pretty perfect little station ID break there. By the way, I'm Maria Hall, your host today on the Lawyers Guild Show. Co-host Jim Lafferty is still on vacation, but he'll be back very soon. And if you're just tuning in, I've been speaking with authors, historians, and activists Andy Piasek and Steve Thornton, authors of Radical Connecticut, People's History of the Constitution State, along with their publisher, Timothy Sheard, from Hardball and Little Heroes Press. I've got a few more questions for you all, but I know that Timothy had wanted to chime in on that last question, because also about theater and music and social justice and turning the tide towards progressive change. And then right after, in a few more minutes too, we have Vinny DiStefano standing by to give us, before the show ends, big news on Julian Assange. So stay tuned for that. But Timothy, I'm going to mute so that it doesn't echo. You're on, please.
Thank you so much, Maria. I wanted to add that in this wonderful book that Steve and Andy have written, they also have a couple of chapters about labor arts, especially theater and music. And they point out that a lot of theater people have been involved in social justice, and these movements really help to turn the tide of public opinion. So they have articles about Mark Twain, Carl Sandburg, Anne Sokolow, and you know what? They even have an article on Katharine Hepburn, which I found just wonderful. And she talks about how these people involved in the theater have been involved in the social justice action and supporting labor rights for decades, for many years. And I think it just added a certain spice to the whole book to have labor arts involved in social justice movements.
You can see how important that kind of work is based on the reaction, because in the 30s you had something called the Federal Theater Project that is part of what a couple of the chapters in the book are, and that was the beginning of what was called HUAC, when congressional investigators began to attack theater and the other arts, but their main emphasis was on theater, because it was inspired by communism, because it was too radical, because it was calling into question the social order, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And unfortunately, successfully shut down the Federal Theater Project within a matter of just a couple years. And then, if not that much later, less than 10 years, where what's become known as the Hollywood Blacklist begins, where you had many, many left-wing screenwriters and directors working in movies during the heyday of Hollywood in the 30s and 40s, producing movies that, you know, weren't necessarily great by any kind of standard, but were, to one extent or another, attempting to address important social issues of the time. And much of that was wiped out, too, much as the Federal Theater Project was, because all of a sudden people were no longer able to work, and there was a very chilling message sent by what was done to folks, that, look, there's a certain kind of movie or play or whatever that you can do, but if you try to do this other thing, then forget about having a career.
I know, and that music is a way to really communicate to people. It doesn't matter. Music, you can communicate if you're educated, if you're not educated, whatever language you speak, you know, resonates as a human, you know, way of feeling, you know, the empathy, what you were talking about earlier about the compassion. Well, let me ask just the three of you kind of our penultimate question before the very last question about how people can get the book. But how, there are a lot of people I know out there who are feeling disheartened and kind of overwhelmed and bombarded by all of the social media. So what kind of advice, kind of coming from your book, just your experience, kind of hearing people's stories and retelling people's stories, people who do want to make a difference, but, you know, they're saying, well, I don't have a million followers on, you know, whatever, TikTok, you know, how can I make a difference? I'm just one person. What kind of advice would you have to those listeners out there? Let's see, why don't we start with Steve, you want to start?
Sure. I think it was Ella Baker who said, let me tell you something about our movement. Three people are better than no people. And because she kept getting that too. How come we don't have more people at this rally? Starting in your workplace, in your neighborhood, in your apartment building, that's where to find people who think like you do and want to do something. This group can then move into other spheres within the city or within, you know, an international movement like Palestine. It's hard to be one person in a million folks in the street. You can do it, but it's much better to be 10 people walking together supporting each other. We used to call them affinity groups, where people could get strength, inspiration, and they could self-educate. So,
thank you. Andy, how about you?
Very similar to what Steve said. I think also one thing that's important, I've been active in various organizations and campaigns and movements since the 1970s. I think the degree to which people can figure out a way to work harmoniously, even if they don't necessarily agree about every single thing that they may be organizing around, helps a great deal. Because one thing that we don't need is splits and infighting. Any way that people can do that and keep whatever the group is in question together or at least functioning is a big step toward better mental health, shall we say, for each of the people involved in it. Because there's really no reason, I mean, aside from sacrificing basic principles, there's really no reason for people to be fighting over minor things that just because they're trying to prove who's more correct or who's more revolutionary. I would say one other thing is people should draw on the institutions that we have that can help sustain us. And I would mention certainly this radio station, the Pacifica Network as a whole, Hardball Press, local radio stations around the country. You know, if you come home from a hard day's work or a campaign meeting that you where you just don't seem to be making the kind of progress that you'd like, hearing a radio show where they're talking about something, say, for example, this one, or about an active campaign that's going on that is perhaps succeeding or where people have lessons that can be helpful, can really be something that helps sustain people rather than spending an hour and a half or 2 hours of your night tuning in to whatever might happen to be on corporate television. And the same thing goes for the publishing industry. The same thing goes for progressive and radical websites around the country that are in abundance and can be very helpful once people find them. I think that there's such a, I mean, I even want to use the word totalitarian information and media system in the society that all the good work really reaches, unfortunately, only a small portion of the population. And the more that knowledgeable people can spread the word, encourage people to tune into different things like what I've just talked about, I think can be beneficial to people of sustaining themselves and getting through difficult times such as what we're living through today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Andy. We are running out of time. So, Timothy, I want to get your Timothy shared. I wanted to get your last thought on that. Where do you draw your inspiration? What advice do you have? And, of course, where can people get Radical Connecticut People's History in the Constitution State?
Thank you, Maria. Yeah, it's easy to feel alone in this great big world. And if you search, you can do it on social media. Whatever your concern is, whether it's climate or gender or race or labor, whatever your concern is, you can find a group in your neighborhood where there are people who have the same concerns that you do. So go to a meeting. You know, go to an outdoor rally or go to a luncheon. And meet other people and say, you know, I don't know what I can do, but I want to help. I want to take part. And you will find new friends, and you will find you can really make a difference. As far as getting Steve and Andy's wonderful book, of course, you can always get it from my hardballpress.com website, hardballpress.com, or go to your favorite independent bookseller and support your bookseller, and they will be very happy to order the book for you and have it waiting for you the next time you go in.
Wonderful. And how about you, Steve and Andy? Where can people learn more about you and your writing?
I have a website with about maybe 200 stories on it. So, well, most of them are not in the book, you know, maybe 20, 15. It's called shoeleatherhistoryproject.com. shoeleatherhistoryproject.com. That also gives a link to the book, but it's a lot of stories of great people throughout Connecticut and Hartford's history, specifically Hartford.
Very cool.
Well, I'm the one of the group who's still, unfortunately, living in the 20th century, so I don't have a website. What I would suggest is just people Google my name and find various articles that I've written. Some of them include some biographical information that may be insightful or not. And I try, as a rule, to always include my email address with everything that I write and get published. So I'm always happy to hear from people if they want to reach out to me.
Okay, and just for reference, the spelling of your name, your last name, it's Andy, and then P-I-A-S-C-I-K.
Correct.
For people to Google you. Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much to our guests today, authors and historians Andy Piasek and Steve Thornton, and publisher Timothy Sheard of Hardball and Little Heroes Press. Thank you so much for all of this inspiration and for your work, and we will have you on again sometime soon.
Thank you, Maria. Thanks very much.
Yes, thank you very much, Maria.
It's my pleasure. And if you're just tuning in, this is the Lawyers Guild Show on KPFK 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Maria Hall, and we now turn to some important news this week about the ongoing fight by WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, against being extradited to the United States. To bring us up to speed and explain what it all means, I'm very happy to welcome back to the show the National Organizing Director of the U.S. Julian Assange Defense Committee, Vincent DiStefano. Thanks so much for being here on such short notice, Vinny.
Thank you, Marie. It's my pleasure. My pleasure. Always.
Sure. Well, can you start by giving us a quick overview of where Julian Assange currently is and how he got there?
Well, now and for more than 5 years, Julian sits in a tiny prison cell most of the day in Belmarsh Prison, the British equivalent to Guantanamo. It's important to note when I tell you that right off the bat, that he has been convicted of nothing. More importantly, and strange as it seemed, he's been tried for nothing, even at this late date. That's because he spent many years fighting against this incredibly and openly biased British and American judicial systems against extradition to the United States. And the reason he's been fighting is that if he will stand trial in the Eastern District Court of Virginia, which has an unbelievable 98.2% conviction rate. That conviction rate is very frightening to Julian because he faces 175 years imprisonment for the unforgivable crime of honest journalism. Now, as to how he got here, and this will be very brief, he's charged with the release of two tranches of material called the Iraq War Logs and the Afghan War Logs, together consisting of nearly a 500,000 classified and unclassified documents. And those documents show that the U.S. government was lying to the American people and to the people of the world about the actual number of civilians that they were killing, torturing, displacing in Iraq and Afghanistan. In addition to that information, to the highly unacceptable high civilian death toll, these logs prove many, many failures and crimes rising to the level of war crimes that were embarrassing to the U.S. government and its military, but most importantly for our purposes, the U.S. intelligence services. And to that end, within the Iraq war logs, there was one particularly damning piece of evidence, the U.S. regarding U.S. mendacity, that put a target squarely on Julian's back. And this is the collateral murder video. This video shows the unprovoked killing of 11 unarmed Iraqi citizens, including two Reuters reporters and one child with another child badly wounded that showed up at the firefight with the first responders. Now, it's not a firefight because the citizens were unarmed. In the video, you can hear the Apache gunship pilot and gunner laughing like they're playing a video game as they murder unarmed human beings. Now, this video's existence was denied and suppressed by the U.S. for more than 2 years until Chelsea Manning gave it to Julian and he published it. Now, I suggest your listeners, all of them, go to YouTube. And that's not you as in the letter, but YOUtube to see this video for themselves. They can find it at WikiLeaks:collateral murder video Iraq 2007 on YouTube as in YouTube. Now, this video was the final nail in Julian's coffin, so to speak, and that release has led to us where we are today. In fact, that is what led CIA under Mike Pompeo to plot to kidnap and or kill Julian, which included the possibility of a running gun battle on Embassy Row in London. I might add that Julian's defense has brought this to the attention of the court as a reason to halt the extradition. However, the court countered that if Julian is extradited, the possibility of kidnapping and murder are no longer relevant to this case. Now, that argument might be appropriate in, say, The Onion, but not in a court of law. And that's where we are today, Maria.
Ooh, well, thank you for that. So what did I saw Monday morning, I think it was, there was some big news, some big headlines. What
exactly Very big
did
news.
The U, yes, what exactly did the UK court rule this week, and what does it mean?
Okay, now this is like Dickens, the best of times and the worst of time. On Monday, the UK High Court granted Julian Assange permission to appeal his extradition on the grounds that the United States has failed to assure the court that his right to freedom of expression would be protected if he were forced to stand trial in the U.S. The two presiding judges, Justice Jeremy Johnson and Victoria Sharp, have allowed Assange to launch a formal appeal of his extradition because of this apparent violation of British extradition law based on the European Convention on Human Rights that requires the receiving country to allow all extradited persons, regardless of nationality, right to free speech. Now, I might mention Judge Lewis, who represented the U.S. government, refused to back away from another attorney on the case, Gordon Crawford's claim that the U.S. could argue that foreign nationals are not entitled to protection under the First Amendment, at least as it concerns national defense information. In fact, chillingly, Lewis went on even further in an official statement that should terrify all journalists. No one, neither a U.S. citizen nor a foreign citizen, are entitled to rely on the First Amendment in relation to publication of allegedly illegally obtained national defense information that, and I'm making air quoting marks, it poses a threat to national security, end of quote. That statement essentially criminalizes all investigative journalism that involves classified documents regardless of their origin. Let me reemphasize this, because current publication of classified documents is not a crime in the United States, but if Cromberg and Lewis have their way and Julian is extradited, it will become one. I would also like to point out that Lewis claimed once again that Julian gave the names of innocent sources in his releases. Now, this accusation by a legal mind is flat out, there's no way to sugarcoat, a lie, and simply shameful beyond belief. There's absolutely zero evidence. Assange did what Lewis accuses him of doing. In fact, Brigadier General Robert Carr, senior counterintelligence officer who headed the information review task force that investigated the impacts of WikiLeaks disclosures on behalf of the Defense Department, testified under oath that they had uncovered no specific examples of anyone who lost his or her life in reprisals that resulted from the publications of WikiLeaks. To quote General Carr, no one was harmed, and everything published by WikiLeaks was truthful. And Lewis knew this when he continued to peddle this long disproven fact. Now, regardless of all that, this decision is a victory in a case that has very few victories. This is the first time Julian will be able to appeal his indictment under the European Court of Human Rights, and which provides that everyone has the right to free expression, including freedom to hold opinions and to receive and impart information and ideas without interference by public authority, regardless of frontiers. Now, compare that statement to what Lewis and Cromberg say. However, it's important to remember, he can file an appeal, but he's still perhaps another year longer in harsh prison conditions, and his physical and psychological health is deteriorating. He spent over 5 years in Belmarsh without being charged. He spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy before that. So it is good news, but it is bad news because it's one more way they can kick the can down the road.
Now, there had been some rumors that perhaps the Biden administration may drop the charges against Assange, but I don't know how is that a possibility, or what would that mean for him
That's true, Maria, that is. Now, it's a very tough call what the Biden administration will do, because they seem to be all over the map on this. But those rumors that you referred to, that perhaps a deal may be in the works, I'd like to refer to what Barry Pollack, Julian's U.S. attorney, has said. And that kind of unwarranted speculation, because these things have been floated since Kennedy, was in Australia. Caroline Kennedy was in Australia. She made the same notions. And they could harm Julian rather than help. Now, I personally fear that the Biden administration's plan will be to simply use this new hearing to kick the Julian Assange can, so to speak, down the road well past the coming elections. However, I do want to emphasize, in a horribly dark world, this decision is a ray of hope that has had few rays of hope in it.
So what happens now? What's Julian Assange's next step?
Well, Maria, that is an excellent question. The parties have been given until May 24th to submit a proposed outline of the next steps in the appeal. Unfortunately, no hearing date has been set for the next phase. And as I said previously, Assange will remain incarcerated in the infamous Belmarsh prison where he's been held for over 5 years as his health deteriorates. Unless things change dramatically, Julian remained untried and unconvicted, but still incarcerated. And excuse me for saying it this way, it's just a damn shame, because not only is Julian in the dock, our right to know what our governments do in our names and our tax dollars and the rest of the world as well. This case will set a horrible precedent, not just for press freedom here, but press freedom around the world. All we have to do is look at the incarceration of Evan Gershkovich in Russia, and that is a direct antecedent to what's happening to Julian. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
So where can listeners follow what's going on with the efforts to free Julian Assange? You know, where can they find out more?
Thank you for that. They can go to AssangeDefense.org. They can also go to StellaAssange.com. Now, both of those sites on our YouTube channels, looking there, you can find the live stream that we had, a wrap-up that included Stephen Rohde, Marjorie Cohen, and Chip Gibbons, Chip actually reporting from the courthouse on our website. And you can go to our action pages and takes action. What they can do most importantly is we are asking people across the United States to call their congresspersons and ask them to become a co-signer of House Resolution 934. And that resolution is stated as expressing the sense of the House of Representatives that regular journalistic activities are protected under the First Amendment and that the United States ought to drop all charges and attempts to extradite Julian Assange. Currently, there are only 11 co-signers, now both Republicans and Democrats. And I might add to that, that the author of this is Paul Gosar. Now, you know, forgive me for saying this, he's perhaps one of the most horrible human beings on the planet. One of his fellow co-signers is Marjorie Taylor Greene. But along with them, we have Rashida Tlaib, we have Cori Bush, we have Jim McGovern, many others. So this is not a left or a right, a Republican or a Democratic issue. But going to our website, taking action, telling your congressperson, you swore an oath to defend the Constitution when you took office. And now is the time to do that by halting this extradition.
Well, thank you so much for all of that and for your work, Vincent DiStefano, National Organizing Director of the U.S. Julian Assange Defense Committee. And we are about out of time for our show today. So in closing, I want to thank today's guests, activist, historian, and writer Steve Thornton and Andy Piasek, authors of Radical Connecticut, People's History in the Constitution State, Timothy Sheard from Hardball and Little Heroes Press, and Vincent DiStefano from the U.S. Julian Assange Defense Committee. And of course, thanks also to BoardOp, D'Angelo Jones in the studio, my co-host Jim Lafferty, who's still on vacation, and everyone out there listening. So until next week, this is Maria Hall with the Lawyer's Guild Show.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Get up, stand up.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman of the Bradcast, heard right here on KPFK Mondays at 3 p.m. As you know, KPFK is corporate-free, listener-supported radio. But that means we need you to support our work and help drastically shorten our fund drives by joining the KPFK Sustainers Circle today. You can pledge $5, $10, $20, or any amount you like, automatically collected each month to help keep the broadcast and all of the other KPFK shows on the air. Please go to kpfk.org and click Make a Pledge to join the Sustainers Circle and help keep KPFK's important, independent voices on your public airwaves. That's kpfk.org. Please sign up now. And thanks.
Support comes from Book Soup. KPFK Radio presents Serge Tankian signing Down with the System, a memoir of sorts.